Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for January's Nurses Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, veterinary surgeon at City Road Vet Truro, Lizzie Whiting. Thank you, Lizzie. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me speak on your webinar club. We're going to talk about osteoarthritis management in pets, and by that I mean mainly cats and dogs. I got inspired in this area of management after visiting one particularly sad euthanasia with a nursing colleague of mine. Really old arthritic dog who was very, very sad, and we were putting him to sleep because he couldn't move. And the owner's comment, well, there's nothing you could do anyway. And I really wanted to challenge that attitude, which I think quite a number of owners do have, in that there's nothing we can do. Well, no, we can't fix osteoarthritis, but we can make the quality of life for these older pets much, much better. And nurses have a huge role to play in this. They can be a good contact point for the clients, and provide lots of adjunctive therapy as opposed to just the medications. So owners see, vets just prescribe medications, but there are many, many other things we can do to help these dogs with osteoarthritis. So in outline, we'll have a little look at what osteoarthritis is, how we can detect it, what we can do to help, a little bit about joint supplements, a little bit about physio. Main bit we're going to cover is lifestyle alterations, because this is where I feel vet nurses really do have a massive role to play. And just a tiny bit at the end about some cutting edge therapies, more for interest than anything else, because I find them quite fun. If you have any questions, please feel free to type them in and I will try and answer them as we go along or at the end. So, first thing to think about, what is osteoarthritis? Now, you can go to an hour-long lecture just on this subject, so I'm going to keep it short and sweet, and more or less how I explain it to my owners, or the owners of the animals that I see, so they can understand what's going on. And I'm sure you guys know this already, but cartilage lines the bone ends at the joints. It's a shock-absorbing surface and also helps the bone ends move smoothly across one another. The joint is encased in a joint capsule, which contains synovial fluid, joint fluid, and that acts as a lubricant for the joint. So it's a bit more complicated than that, obviously, but that will do for our purposes today, I think. There's four ways that animals can get osteoarthritis. You can have normal stresses on an abnormal joint. So the example I'm using here, which we're very common with in general practice, is hip dysplasia. Hip dysplasia in Labradors, German Shepherds, French Bulldog was my most recent diagnosis. So you have dogs that are just doing normal walking, exercising, running, jumping, but with an abnormal joint. And as you can see from the x-ray on the right, there's lots of radiographic signs of osteoarthritis in this dog, lots of spur formation, abnormal shape of the femoral neck, lots of osteophytic reactions. So these will be painful joints. Normal animals, abnormal joints. This also is the case in elbows as well, and shoulders potentially. The other thing that we can see is abnormal stresses on a normal joint. So the x-ray on the right here was one of my clinical cases. It was a 7-year-old Labrador who was actually presented to me with some urinary tract issues, but the owner said, oh, while we're here, he's also licking his front legs a lot. So he was licking just below the dew claw on the inside of both of his both of his front feet. On questioning them a little bit further, they used one of those ball thrower things every day. So he would chase the ball, skid to a halt, bring it back repetitively for the previous 7 years. So when I anaesthetized him to do his bladder workup, I also took some x-rays of his joints. And as you can see here, there's osteophytic reaction. This is quite thickened as well, and that was quite painful. He was licking over this area because of the pain. So we instigated some arthritis management, alongside sorting out his bladder as well, and the licking decreased, and he was a much happier dog. So this was a completely normal paw to start with, but that repetitive sliding to a halt had put strain on that particular joint and caused arthritis. Joint injuries are another one. These x-rays are courtesy of my husband, Colin Whiting. So broken elbow, this is probably a Springer Spaniel because it's a elbow fracture. It's an articular fracture, so there will be damage to cartilage here, all repaired with all sorts of exciting metalwork, but you can't repair, you can realign your joint surfaces, but you've got damage there. So it is likely that this joint in the future will become arthritic. And one that we mustn't forget, it's much less common than the hip dysplasia or the wear and tear, but immune-mediated arthritis does happen. Often these dogs are lame in multiple limbs. Generally, with adequate management, the ongoing osteoarthritis doesn't last. If they're not caught, then yes, you can get quite considerable damage to the synovium and to the cartilage. So this is one that is nice to pick up on Joint Tap because you've got an answer to that one. So the deal with arthritis, it's not just that initial injury. So it's not just that initial fracture. It's not just that that abnormal joint or the abnormal stresses. Once you have damaged cartilage, you have a vicious cycle of increasing problems with the arthritic joint. So your damaged cartilage starts to expose the bone ends, which causes pain. So it's actually the exposed bone that is the painful bit. The cartilage itself doesn't have any nerve supply to it. The bone endings do. You get release of collagen type 2 from the cartilage. Now, normally that's held in a protected site. So inside cartilage, the immune system can't access it. When it's released in damaged cartilage, the immune system can access it and recognises it as foreign. So as I say to owners, it's great that your immune system can recognise bacteria and viruses as foreign and attack them. It's not so helpful when the protein that they're attacking is actually part of the animal. That sets up inflammation. Lots of inflammatory mediators are released, of which they have all sorts of complicated names. And as I say, other lectures can tell you way more about this, but inflammatory mediators, junk is released into the joint. These irritate the joint, you get more inflammation, so you get more inflammatory mediators, you get more cartilage damage because of the inflammation, and this just cycles round and round. You lose the gliding surface because you've got cartilage damage. You may have a reduction in the synovial fluid volume, you may get an increase in the synovial fluid volume. Both of those can cause problems. If you have reduced synovial fluid, you've got no lubrication in the joint. If you have increased synovial fluid production, you get stretching of the joint capsule, and that stretching is painful. You can get decreased viscosity, decreased stickiness of the joint fluid. So instead of it being a nice, thick, oily stuff that's lubricating the joint, it becomes quite watery and not as effective at doing its job. And the other thing that causes pain is the inflammation of the soft tissue structure surrounding the joints. We often forget about that. We look at the x-ray, we see, look, there's all those bony spurs. You can't assess the cartilage on an x-ray. You also can't really assess the soft tissues, but those are the ones that contain the nerve endings. Those are sending the signals to the animal's brain to say, ow, this hurts. So that's where the source of the pain is. And it's, as I say, it cycles round and it's a vicious circle. So unless we can interrupt that cycle of degradation, inflammation, further degradation, further inflammation, we're not going to get anywhere. And then we also have to bear in mind that this is a chronic condition. It's not just the owners may report, oh, he's fine some days and not fine the others. Well, on the days where he appears fine, he's probably got some degree of pain. He's just not exhibiting it particularly on that day. And when you have a chronic painful focus, you will get physical changes to the central nervous system. You can get increased perception to pain. So how I describe this is a little bit that like that feeling when you have the flu. If somebody touches you, like, oh, get off. and it can just be a, you know, a light touch, but you're much more sensitized to that feeling, and you perceive it as painful. So all pain is in the brain, essentially. So we have information from our periphery cycled into the brain, and the brain is where the pain is perceived, and you do get increased perception with a long-standing condition. And we do have to bear this in mind. These dogs can become very, very sad, very miserable. A lot of them are dogs like Labradors, Spaniels, very stoic dogs, so they do internalize it a lot. They will carry on. They will want to walk. They will want to eat. They will want to do this and the other. But it doesn't mean that they're not in pain. So, how do we spot it? There's various subjective and objective measures. Now, spotting these dogs, as I say, owners are not usually very good at spotting that their dogs are in pain, and certainly not very good at spotting their dogs are in arthritic pain. Partly this is because it's a slow degradatory process, so they just put it down to the dog becoming old. He's slowing down a bit. They will use all these different words. He's just getting a bit stiff. He's a bit lazy. He doesn't want to jump, but he's getting old. So, you know, we expect that. But this is where us doing health checks, geriatric clinics, checks at vaccination checks, at 6 month health checks, can start to pick up on this language that the owners are using and start to question, well, actually, is there a reason why this dog is slowing down, getting stiff, becoming a bit lazy? It's quite nice to have in your armory some sort of objective lifestyle questionnaire. My practice uses the LOAD score, the Liverpool Osteoarthritis Questionnaire, which has been validated. So the score you get does correlate to a degree of arthritis. So the numbers per se don't give you this is how bad it is. It is a tracking device. So there will be individual variations with owners scoring their dog. But what you can do is track that dog's progress over time. So you can get a baseline one, and then if you perform some sort of intervention, look, the score is going down. And the CBPI, the Canine Brief Pain Inventory, is similar. Elanco have the copyright to the load scoring, so you can receive training from them on using load scores, and then you have permission to print out the questionnaires to give them to clients. I find it a really useful tool. It comes up with a number. You can say, well, look, your dog's got a score of over 20. Arthritis is likely to be affecting his quality of life. And it just gives a subjective measure. It has been validated against forced plate analysis, so there is a it does have validity that the scoring is related to arthritic pain. And all these sort of things opens discussions into osteoarthritis. And if you are thinking that that is a likely thing that's going on, then you can refer them back to the veterinary surgeon and say, look, I think this dog has got some arthritis. Can we start investigating the diagnostics and some management plans? And then my preferred option for these is to then work closely with the nurse that spotted them. So I'll do the x-rays and the prescribing the drugs bit, and then send them back for another nurse clinic to discuss the lifestyle management and other things that we can do, because the more different aspects you can affect in these dogs, then the better response you're going to get, and the increasing the quality of life for these older patients. Cats are a little bit more challenging, I think. Osteoarthritis is much underdiagnosed in cats, partly because you don't take a cat for a walk. Well, you can, but you're not going to get very far. So you may have come across these signs of pain in cats. I think Boehringer advertised them when they were talking about Metacam for long-term arthritis management in cats. So you've got your scratchy cat, the one that's become much more grumpy, less amenable to being picked up, just doesn't want to know anymore. You got scratchy. You have scruffy, the cat that won't groom anymore, particularly over the, I find quite often with cats, it's particularly over the hindquarters and mid back because they can't stretch round to really have a good clean of that area. A lot of cats have spinal arthritis, so stretching round to get round to their back end is sore. And then when you try and groom them, they become quite scratchy and angry because they're painful. This is my cat showing how he doesn't have arthritis because he can get all the way around to his bottom. Sleepy. Again, this is my cat. He doesn't have arthritis, but it was a nice picture of a sleeping cat. He does this a lot. But you will find with arthritic cats, they will be even more sleepy than the average cat. So they will just rest. They won't want to do anything. They'll get up, go and have some food, and go back to sleep again. The other thing that they will do, and this is probably, I find them the most useful one for spotting arthritic cats, is that they, owners sometimes describe it as he's become lazy. He doesn't want to jump anymore. And you'll see them sat on the edge of a table, a high surface, or sat on the floor looking up at a high surface. And they sort of do intention movements. They rock forward as though they want to go, but then they know it's going to be painful, so they pull back and they rock forward. So they'll hesitate about jumping up or jumping across things that they used to do quite happily. So they may be described as lazy, but actually they're just anticipating pain. This is quite a nice little diagram to show owners. Again, because it's a chronic condition that comes on slowly, owners will not always realize the changes in the behavior in their cat. So going through pictures like this, say, look, did your cat used to just jump down off the table and now he doesn't? Did he used to run up and down stairs? Now he doesn't. Is he playful anymore? Does he go via a chair to get down off a table? Does he use different methods of getting up and down? We know cats like to jump up and perch, but if they're finding it painful to get up there, then they're going to find an alternative route. So this, I found this really, really useful in talking to cat owners. And sometimes you just get that light bulb moment. They'll go, oh yeah, he doesn't do that anymore. And then once you've got them on board with the fact that there may well be a problem, then it just makes life much, much easier to try and say, well, actually, there are some things we can do. So physical examination, obviously, you guys can perform physical examination. This will also be repeated when they go back to the veterinary surgeon if you refer them back to them, which would be great. So this is me doing a hip extension exam. Always a little bit wary of this because with a dog with really painful hips, they will sometimes turn around and have a little bit of a go at you. So just be a bit careful. So palpating all the joints, putting them through their range of motion, extending the elbow forward, and putting a little bit of downward pressure on the paw to really extend that elbow. You can detect pain on that quite readily doing that. Feeling the stifle, is that swollen and inflamed? And then obviously this is a hip extension exercise. Radiographs, I do try and encourage owners to take radiographs, particularly if I think that they're not very convinced that their dog has arthritis, because you show them a picture like this, you could show them a normal elbow x-ray, and then they go, ah, yes, okay, we do have a problem. So it is a useful tool in that. It can be useful to help track progress as well. There's always the balance between some clients won't want to anaesthetize their older dog, so that's a discussion to be had, with concurrent illnesses, but 20 minutes worth of x-raying can be very beneficial. And the other thing that we can do at the same time is to perform joint taps. So if we've got multiple limb lameness, dog may have other signs of the immune mediated arthritis. This is a really useful tool to help rule that out. So we've got our diagnosis of arthritis. What can we do to help? Because what we want to achieve for these animals is for them to lead as normal a life as possible. So dogs want to be out for walks, they want to be running and sniffing and having fun. Cats want to be jumping up on things and hunting, and even if they're just hunting leaves or balls, they want to be mentally stimulated. So my aim is always to try and get as good a quality of life as possible for these older pets. So first thing to think about is the pain pathway and whereabouts can we influence it? Because getting these animals comfortable enough to be able to exercise is key. So there's different parts of the pain pathway and different of the medications and tactics that we use will focus on different areas of the pain pathway. So you have your pain perception at the joint, the pain, the nerve impulse transfer up the nerves, perception in the spinal cord, and then the processing of the pain in the brain. So different drugs will act along different parts of that pathway. Now, I alluded to this earlier, using multimodal management, so using more than one strategy, is going to get a better effect than just one strategy. So if you have a 50 kilo Labrador and you put him on Remedil or Metacam or whichever, yes, you will get some improvement, but until you shift that extra weight, you're not going to get as good an improvement than if you do more than one thing. So we'll discuss each of these in turn. But actually, if you're looking at that wheel, the weight management, the physiotherapy, the nutrition, to a certain extent, the joint supplement side of it, that can all be discussed by veterinary nurses. See, vet nurses have a massive part to play in arthritis management. Obviously, the prescribing of the medications is down to the vet, so it's all about a team-based approach. Owners often worry about putting their dogs on non-steroidals. I think there's a few aspects to this I've come across, and I have different ways of explaining this to clients. So my first question is, what is it that you're worried about? Now, often people will know that if they take non-steroidals themselves, they get stomach upsets and gastritis and things like that. And they worry, I don't want him on drugs for a long period of time. So the ways I start to explain that is that particularly the newer non-steroidals we have are much more COX selective. So they select for the COX-2, which is more involved in the pain and inflammation pathways, and less so for the stomach and kidney function. Dogs, I think, generally are more robust than people at dealing with non-steroidals. I think that, you know, many, many dogs do really well on non-steroidals. I think more people have more problems. I don't have any figures for that, but that's the general impression I get. In the grand scheme of things, dogs are on them for less time. So if you're a person with hip dysplasia, you may need to start taking non-steroidals from the age of 30 or 35, and you might live to your 70. So that's a really long period of time that you're taking non-steroidals for. Our dogs, we generally start diagnosing with arthritis maybe 8, 9, 10 years of age. And if you're a Labrador, you're probably going to make it to 12, possibly 13. So they're on for a much shorter period of time. The other really important thing with dogs and cats is they live in the moment. So they have no perception that if I take this drug, there is a potential it will shorten my life by 6 months, 3 years down the line. All they know is I'm sore now and I can't chase that ball, or I can't go for a walk. I can't get up and down off the chair like I want to. So because they live very much in the moment, I think it's really, really important that we give them pain relief now. Owners want their dogs to live a long time. The dog wants to be happy and comfortable. So it's quite a change in perception for owners to sometimes come to terms with, and it's just a case of talking them through the options. And most of the time, they say, "Well, yes, I would rather he was comfortable now, and we'll, you know, accept the risks that there may be potentially some side effects in the future." I tend to find with non-steroidals, if they're going to vomit or have diarrhea or have gastric upsets, it's generally within the first 2 weeks, and then we can resolve it with supportive management, try them on a different NSAID, will potentially they'll suit those better. I don't in practice tend to see so much of the long-term problem. Obviously, routine blood testing and checkups and what have you are essential when they're on these medications, but the benefit they get from the pain relief far exceeds the potential for side effects, in my opinion. Add in medications. So when they've been on NSAIDs for a while and they start to slow down again, the load score's going up, they're finding owners are finding the dogs are having problems. I like to add in paracetamol. Pardale is a licensed one. It's only got a short-term license, but I do use this long-term. Gives great adjunctive therapy, and it's more centrally acting. So the NSAIDs are acting on the peripheral pathways. The paracetamol is acting centrally. There's quite a drive for tramadol, that being useful. I think there's been a recent paper out saying maybe not as much as we hoped. I don't tend to prescribe tramadol so much anymore. I think some dogs do well on it, but it's unreliable in how the benefit it's gonna have for that dog. And then some of the other things, amantadine is in the same class of drugs as ketamine, really good centrally acting pain relief. Again, you get a small incremental improvement. So I find it can be a really useful add-on. I wouldn't use it instead of non-steroidals, unless there's a really good reason why I definitely can't use non-steroidals. So it's not enough on its own, but it can be useful as a top-up. And gabapentin, again, the jury's out a little bit how much benefit this gives. It's theoretically more with neuropathic pain than osteoarthritic pain, but it's another one that's out there. So your vets will, discuss these with the clients. Joint supplements. Owners love joint supplements. They really want to give it some sort of supplement because they think that that's going to be the answer. They think that they can do that because joint supplements are natural and less dangerous than non-steroidals. There's been various papers done over the years. I think there was one paper in the 80s that had showed a really positive benefit. That's never been repeated subsequently to have such a good benefit. Looking at reviews of all the papers done, some show mild benefit, some show no change. On balance, the joint supplements probably aren't as helpful as we'd like them to be. There is a variety. I mean, the turmeric is something that people are really, really excited about. The active ingredient is curcumin, and there was a paper done when they were releasing Seroquin to say that, yeah, there is a mild benefit to be had by giving curcumin, the active ingredient, to turmeric. Greenlit mussel is popular. Those are some sardines. That's the fatty acids, evening primrose oil, glucosamine, and chondroitin from cartilage. Those are the best bits I could come up with for that. So glucosamine hydrochloride is more bioavailable than glucosamine sulfate. Yeah, there may be some benefit. I always say to clients, if they're going to spend their money on something, spend it on the non-steroidals, because you've definitely going to get a benefit with those. With these, yeah, it's not going to do any harm, but how much good is it actually going to do? I think what we used to do was give joint supplements first and then add in the non-steroidals. I think the thinking has changed, partly because we know that joint supplements maybe aren't as effective as we'd like them to be. Also, if we can reduce inflammation in that arthritic joint, you're reducing the release of the inflammatory mediators, so you're breaking that inflammatory cycle. So you're getting less damage to the cartilage, less damage to the synovial fluid, less damage to the soft tissue structures of the joint. So you're improving the environment in that joint, and you're not getting the vicious cycle going round and round of degradation, inflammation, degradation, inflammation. So actually, the non-steroidals earlier in course of disease are going to slow, or theoretically will slow, progression of the arthritis much better than a joint supplement. Omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. So the only clinically proven way of getting sufficient supplement into the animal is JD. When they bought JD out, they did force plate analysis. So they got lame dogs to run over a force plate, saw how much pressure they were putting through their lame leg, fed them the diet for 30 days, and then after 30 days, those dogs showed increased force through the lame leg. So there is good data to say that this does work. There's a variety of reasons why you can't use JD. You've got dietary problems, skin issues, concurrent problems like that. I used to find with Labradors, they would put on quite a bit of weight because it is quite fatty. Because the only way to get enough omega-3 and omega-6 in is to feed it as the diet. But they do JD Light now, which does help with that. And you do have to change, I always say, change over the diet over a period of 2 weeks, so much longer than you would normally do for a diet change, because it does contain high levels of oils and fats. So you can cause gastroenteritis if you change over too quickly. As long as they do it nice and slowly, and just keep an eye on their weight, so keep weighing them every month, then I think I do quite like this. It's more expensive. It's basically a supplement plus a dog food, high quality dog food. But it is a good stuff. One of the more recent things to come out is Flexidine Advance. I really like the theory of this. I think I have seen some improvement in some dogs using it in practice. I think there isn't a massive amount of data out there about it. If owners really want to give a joint supplement, I tend to steer them towards the Flexidine Advance. The idea behind it is that it contains a modified version of collagen type 2, UC2, which is then detected in the white cells of the gut, and they become desensitized to it, so they're less likely to cause an inflammatory response to the UC2 in the joint. That's kind of the theory. There's a little bit more to it than that. It's a bit of a slow burner because you're trying to decrease the body's reaction to something. It will take at least a month, probably more like 2 months, to show a benefit. But if owners do stick with it, I have certainly seen some improvement. They love it. It's one chew per dog. That goes down really nicely. So it's a nice thing. I definitely watch this space with this one. It'd be nice to see a little bit more trial work on it to see how well it's doing. Now I'm briefly going to talk about hydrotherapy and physiotherapy. I'm not a physiotherapist. I do have one that I refer to, so it's worth finding out near your practice who is a good veterinary or good animal physio, because I think this can be really, really beneficial for dogs, particularly the hydrotherapy with the chubby dogs, because they can exercise, they can help burn off some calories, lose some weight, but with using the water to support them, so they're getting less force through their joints, so it's nicer for them to exercise in that way. So non-weight bearing exercise. Owners will say, "Oh well, I can take him down to the river to swim." Well, you can. It's not the same as going for hydrotherapy. So what the with the hydrotherapy pools, it's nice and warm. So it is non-weight bearing exercise. It's a stable floor that they can be on, or they can be supported when they're swimming. They can be dried off. They can have harnesses on them to help support them. Very different from, say, going in the sea where they're going to get knocked about by the waves, or going in a really cold river and then having to walk back to the car freezing cold. Muscle massage and gentle joint exercises are good as a warm-up for this. Do try and find a qualified animal physiotherapist. So they have to be a human physiotherapist first, and then they have top-up training. The physiotherapist I use does use laser. I think that there's limited value in it. There's little proven evidence. They can't prove a mechanism for it. I think it probably does warm up the tissues, so that probably feels quite nice, but I don't think that some of the claims that are made are necessarily supported by evidence. So I don't go a bundle on laser therapy. I know it's one of those quite emotive things. Again, you could spend your money on a course of laser therapy, or you could spend your money on a course of hydrotherapy. I go for the hydrotherapy. You could also spend it on a course of non or you, the owner, spend it on their non-steroidals. Better spending it on the non-steroidals and then add these other things in. Not so much on the laser. Owners do like the thought of laser, but there isn't much evidence to prove its benefit and how it actually works. So lifestyle changes. This again, as I alluded to earlier, this is where vet nurse clinics really come into their own, because so much of this stuff is really straightforward for owners to get the hang of, but they need time and support to help implement them. But I think the improvement to the animal's quality of life can be huge by doing just a few simple changes around the home. I do have to say that the nurse I went to on that very first on that euthanasia that I spoke to right at the beginning, Becky Palmer, she and I worked very closely together, and so she sort of gave me the outline for doing this section of the presentation. The other really useful resource is Canine Arthritis Management. If you look them up, there's all sorts of owner resources on there. Really, really helpful. This is kind of a summary of the key parts to it that I find really useful. Again, the vet's in a consult, 10 or 15 minute consult. We don't have time to go through all of this, but it's so important to add these aspects onto it. This is where I say, if it's picked up at a nurse clinic, refer back to the vet. We can do the drug bits and the x-ray bits, refer them back for their arthritis clinics. And owners like to have that contact with coming back in, seeing somebody for their weight checks and everything else. It's a really, really good way to bond clients to your practice. So, weight management. Number one, the best thing you can do for an arthritic dog is to get them to lose weight. Probably even better than non-steroidals. It's the single most important treatment modality for supporting arthritic pets. There's plenty of evidence to prove this. So chubby on the left is going to struggle. Nice lean one on the right is going to do much better. Same with cats. It is more of a ch I do understand it's much more of a challenge to get weight off a cat. It is possible, but it does take quite a lot of owner dedication. So supporting the owner through the journey is really important. Interesting stats here, which I do like to use for clients, particularly ones that really are not feeling like they're getting the hang of it. For every kilo overweight a pet is at exercise, this can exert an extra 7 kilos of force through an arthritic limb. And when you consider that, that's quite a considerable amount. I mean, 7 kilos, what's that? That's a Jack Russell Terrier worth of extra force through these arthritic limbs. And that increases hugely when they're jumping. So if they're jumping up into the car or landing out of the car, jumping off the bed, it can be up to an extra 50 kilos of force for every kilo overweight they are. So if you've got the Labrador that should be 35 kilos and is 45 kilos, so that's 70 kilos of extra force through the joint just at normal exercise. And 500 kilos, so an entire cow's worth of force when jumping up. So that's why these dogs don't want to jump up. They don't want to jump down. They will hesitate. They want to go for their walks. They'll sit in the back of the car. They'll dither. They won't want to go because they know it's going to hurt. They anticipate the pain. So start them on a reducing diet. It's basic. So you know how to do weight clinics. I'm sure you've all had education in these. So working out what they're on, what they need to be, their target weights. JD Light is one to consider. There's all sorts of different diets on there, metabolic, the Purina one, satiety, and JD Light. I think quite an interesting aspect to weight clinics is the owner's perception of what food means between them and the dog, particularly dogs, cats to a certain extent. But often owners equate food to love. If I feed my dog, it shows him I love him. Where the dog sees food as a resource. If you keep feeding him, he'll keep eating. Doesn't mean he'll love you anymore. He'll know that you're the source of the food, but they don't equate it in the same way. So with people, if we want to show someone we love them, we take them out for a nice meal, we'll home cook them something really special, we'll give somebody a box of chocolates, things like that. So food and affection is very closely linked in human society. Where dogs are different, food is food, food is fuel, food is quite fun if you're a Labrador, but it's not the same as building a bond with them. They will go to anybody that feeds them. So kind of unpicking that from the owners and then saying, actually, what will bond you more to your dog is spending some time playing with them, doing tricks, doing brain games, giving them mental stimulation. That builds more of a bond with the owner and the pet than just food. So sometimes just exploring that can really help with your weight management. And we always get the owners, well, he won't eat the diet food unless I put beef on it, or unless I put this on it, or unless I put chicken on it. And my answer to that, well, it's a little bit like eating salad and having Mars bars for croutons. And it's amusing, but they kind of try and get the picture. Of course, there will be some clients that you will never get through to. All you can do is try. So I do understand it's difficult. Having targets, having a, oh yes, we've reached this target, all really helps. But it's the best thing you can do for these dogs. The other thing with these dogs is, particularly dogs and cats as well, but particularly with dogs, they're exercising less generally because they're painful. They can't go as far, and they get quite depressed. And they have their food time, and with a Labrador, it might last good 3 or 4 seconds, and then they're just back to just sitting on the bed or mooching around the house. So making food time stimulating can really help with their mental welfare. Can also slow down their eating, so it makes the fun time last for longer. So there's different ways you can do this. So they will have reduced exercise times, reduced mental stimulation because they can't go as far, and they've become depressed. So giving them activity feeders, so making it more fun. There's all sorts of different ones out there. You can do something as simple as putting it in a cardboard tube and they have to rip the cardboard tube apart to get the food. You can buy activity feeders. If it's nice dry weather, I quite like getting the owners to take a handful of the food and scatter it in the lawn, particularly with the hunting dogs. They love to use their sense of smell, and they'll go and they'll mooch around and they'll find the biscuits, and it gives them more to do. They're having to expend a bit of energy to get their food. It's making food time last longer, making it more fun for them. So different ways of making food time more stimulating can really help their mental welfare. Making it comfortable as well. So owners will say, well, if he eats, there's nothing wrong with him. He's not in pain. He's eating. Well, the dog's eating because he has to eat. They're not going to starve themselves. They have to be in pretty dire straits to not want to eat. But that doesn't mean it doesn't hurt. So you'll sometimes see these dogs, they'll eat, they'll do some slightly odd things to make feeding more comfortable. They might lie down to eat. They might choose to only eat at certain times. So if they've got neck and elbow problems, these raised feeders are great. If they've got hip and knee problem, if they're having to chase their food bowl around the floor, that can cause them additional pain. So just give them a non-slip mat, so the food bowl is staying still, and just making it a bit easier for the dog, because they will eat regardless, but it doesn't mean we can't make it better for them. So, looking at the common things that dogs do every day, so they eat every day. There's various things we can do. So we can reduce their food, and we can make feeding time more fun and more comfortable for them. The other thing they have to do every day is go outside for a pee and a poo. There's various areas that this can actually be really challenging for some of these arthritic dogs. And say cats as well, to a certain extent, if they're expected to jump out of a window, that can cause them pain. So altering their ways that they can access, but steps for old dogs can be quite a trip hazard. Imagine if you have arthritic elbows and you're going up those steps and you trip and you hit your elbow on them. That'd be really sore. So providing them with ramps, alternative ways of getting up and down to the garden, just makes the things that they have to do every day a bit easier. They have to go down the steps. They know they have to go down the steps to go for a pee and a poo. Just make it easy for them. Thresholds, some thresholds are really quite high in some properties, so they have to really flex a painful elbow or a painful knee up to get over them. So again, providing some sort of ramp or something like that to help them get up and over. And these PVC thresholds can be quite slippery. So if they put their foot on that and the leg slips sideways, it can jar a pain. When I say I talk about elbows quite a lot because I think elbow pain is particularly unpleasant. The elbow is a very unforgiving joint. So when it gets arthritis, it can be really quite debilitating for them. But their elbow slips sideways. Oh, that's intensely painful. And they've got to get in. You sometimes see them hesitating at a doorway. We see them in the practice. We have to have those, shiny Alpro flooring, whatever, for cleanliness. But those dogs sometimes really struggle coming into the practice. So I try, if I know I've got an arthritic dog coming in, I'll put a bed down so they've got somewhere comfy to sleep. So these all can be areas that we need to think about, problem areas. So you can put harnesses on them to support them when they're using steps, ramps up to the doors. You can get a non-slip tape to put on thresholds. So I think it's marketed for people as well that have older people that like to slip, stick it on the thresholds, non-slip mat inside the door. Sorry about my spelling error. So as they come through the door, they're not onto the laminate floor, and then they're skidding across that. So they've just got a nice, comfortable access into the house. Could just make going in for a pee and a poo much more comfortable for them. So this is the non-slip tape. You can get it if you just Google non-slip tape. You can get it. I think you can get it through the Canine Arthritis Management website as well. I did briefly mention cats, so getting in and out the house can be more challenging for them. So providing them with an easy way in and out is a kindness for them. Don't forget, they may not want to compete for their outside toileting areas. So cats, being quite territorial creatures, will have an area that they go, but if anyone moves into their area and starts, arguing with them for that they want to have the raised bed or whatever for their toileting area, some of these arthritic cats just don't want to fight back once they become sore and painful. So providing them with a safe place to go is a kindness for them. And high-sided litter trays is great for keeping the litter in one place, but if you've got a painful back, painful elbows, painful hips, trying to climb in and out of that tray is going to be uncomfortable if you're a cat. And if you're a cat, you'll then go to somewhere that's easier. So you'll start peeing on the doormat or pooing in the corner. And so you can get these inappropriate elimination issues, which may well stem from osteoarthritic pain. So sometimes with cats, again, going back to how cats present with arthritic pain, I don't think I've ever had an owner come in and say, "I think my cat's got arthritis because he's limping." They'll come in and say, "Oh, my cat's peeing on the doormat. He's only just started doing that since he's got a bit older." Or he won't go outside he wants to use a litter tray now, and it's a bit of a pain. You sort of take it back, and there's obviously many, many reasons why, but sometimes it is just because they're painful and they're sore and they don't want to jump in and out or fight for somebody else to use their litter tray. So, low-sided litter trays or the low access point. I really like this Oko cat litter. It's nice and soft underfoot. It doesn't slide under them like the pine the little pellet things. And really nice thing about it as well is it forms a so when they pee it forms a gel clump, and you could just take the gel clump out and leave the rest of the litter. So you don't have to bin the whole lot every time. So it's a little bit more expensive than your normal cat litter, but it's actually quite nice. It's nice and soft, and they seem to like using it. So indoor mobility problems. There's many houses now that are downstairs. A house is laminate tiling, laminate flooring is maybe less of a thing. It was maybe more popular 10 years ago or so. But houses do still have laminate, or they'll have nicely sanded and varnished floorboards. We have tiled kitchen areas, tiled hallways, which are great for keeping the place clean. Not so good if you're an arthritic dog. So you see this poor spaniel has gone splat here. If that dog had arthritic hips, just imagine the pain that he's going to be experiencing. It just makes me wince to think about that. These beautiful wooden stairs look amazing. A dog trying to get up there, and they're going to skid and slide all over the place. It's going to be uncomfortable for them. Any sort of slipping, jarring of these joints out of what the animal expects, it's going to be, "Oh, ow, that's sore." So there are solutions to this. Some clients are going to be way more up for this than others. I do get that. But these runners, floor mats, can provide, you can link them together to provide walkways for the dogs to get to the places they need to get to. So from door to bed, from bed to food, from food to door. You can give them non-slip areas, so you can pick them up quite easily. They have like a rubber back. They'll sit on the floor and the dog can go down the mat. And actually, sometimes when you question owners, you'll find the dog is doing this already because they're quite clever. So they'll choose to go on the non-slip flooring. You can put non-slip sticky things on the front of the stairs. This may not be so aesthetically pleasing for clients, but you can also get this non-slip tape. It's not a bad idea if you're wearing socks going up down wooden stairs as well. But the see-through tape may be a little bit more owner-friendly if they do really love their wooden stairs. Or if they definitely don't want to do anything like that, just baby gating off the stairs. The dog isn't running up and down them. So stair gates, the top and bottom, various different ways of doing it. If the clients, for example, have upside down living, so the dog has to go upstairs, harnesses to support them. It does look a little bit like this chap is just hauling his dog upstairs, but it's just a harness to support the dog to give him a bit of extra boost to get upstairs. So that is a possibility as well. The solutions have to be based on what the client is able to do. So I tend to give them a range of options and then let them choose what's going to fit with their home. Sleeping arrangements. Now, these dogs do sleep more, and the cats will sleep more, which there are things that we provide for them which may not be the most beneficial for the animal. Insufficient padding. So, at vet practices, we love a vet bed because it wicks away the wee and all this sort of thing. They're easy to clean and dry. If you have an arthritic animal coming in for a day case, that's not enough padding for them. So you can get yoga mats or foam tiles, like children's flooring, jigsaw tiles. I tend to put those underneath, newspaper on top, then the bedding on top of that, maybe one or two beds as well, just to pad them up a little bit more. But owners will sometimes use vet beds at home, and that's all they'll give their dogs. They put the vet bed on the tiled floor. It's not a lot of padding. If you sit on that, go in the corner and sit on one of those for 10 minutes. You start to feel bits that you didn't know that were aching. So that's actually quite a useful exercise to go and get someone to go and sit on the floor on one of those for a bit. Drafts, because the dogs sleep at floor level, so drafts can impact them. Just feeling a bit chilly will make them feel more achy and more painful. High steps. I love this bed. It looks amazing. If that dog had hip arthritis, climbing up into that bed's going to be quite a challenge. They'll probably choose not to use it. So it looks lovely, very designer, lovely thing. Not so good if you've got arthritis. And slippery blankets. So often dogs will be given an old duvet to sleep on. But when the dog tries to get up from this, the two layers are going to slip against one another. And that can cause them problems because, again, you've got that sliding and jarring of the joints, which can be quite uncomfortable for them. Some dogs like to be able to snuggle in, but I usually try and give them a little bit more support. Ideally, a memory foam mattress. There are various ones available. So as the dog sits on it, they sink into it. They may want an extra blanket on top to pad it up. There's one place that's near us that makes memory foam mattresses for human beds, and they sometimes have off cuts. So you can try and get owners to go and look for off cuts, so that is a bit cheaper than buying one, but some people are quite happy to spend 100 quid on a memory foam mattress for their dog, and they are really nice and supportive and much more padded for the arthritic dogs. Draft excluders, that's what it says on the tin. And for cats, as I say, they love to rest up high, so just providing them a different way of getting up to their favourite resting spaces, so a steps or a box or something like that, so they can get up there. Instead of just having to make a one big jump, they can get there much more gradually, and then they'll be happier. They can rest where they want to rest. Exercise. So arthritic dogs definitely do need to exercise. So some people say, "Oh, I need to rest him." No, if you rest him, he'll get more stiff, he'll lose muscle mass, and we'll have a decreasing spiral of ability. And also, arthritic dogs that are denied exercise do become depressed. And then their quality of life drops, and they just become really miserable and introverted and quite sad. And that's not what we want for our beloved pets in their latter years. The challenges. Challenging with exercise dogs, they can't forward plan. So they'll go, "Yay, I'm exercising, it's brilliant." And they'll get halfway on the walk and then find, "Oh, I can't get back again, I've gone too far." Dogs, generally, especially in their latter years, they are really loyal and they will continue to walk even if it's painful for them. And they'll plod along behind and you can see them step by step. "Oh, it's sore, but Dad's going for a walk. I must follow them. I must follow them." Don't forget, adrenaline is a massively brilliant analgesic. It will mask pain. So getting owners. And they also don't, they don't whine and they don't cry. They'll just endure the pain. Getting owners to assess pain at home rather than when they're on the walk is important. They start to lose agility and ability to jump. So if there's a walk that they go on that has stiles, they're going to start to struggle with those. So they need a little bit of help for that. And uneven and sinking terrain. So I'm down in Cornwall, So we have lots of beaches, and clients will take their dogs for a walk on the beach. But that deep sand, it's hard work for a person to walk through. If you're arthritic, it's really quite hard work, and really deep, sinky mud can be quite difficult for these dogs. So, as I said before, judge the pain on their behaviour at home, not when they're on a walk, because they will be wanting to run around. So don't judge them on how sore they are when they're out. It's how they are at home. Owners have to be switched on to how much exercise their dog is actually able to achieve, and the owners need to be limiting the exercise to a sensible amount. Little and often is way more better. Sorry. Is way better than going for a 5 mile walk on every day at the weekend and then nothing during the week. If they can go for 2 or 3, even 3 or 4, 20 minute to half hour walks through the day, that's much better for them. Other modifications. Ball chasing, sudden starts and stops, not really appropriate for arthritic dogs. Front legs, back legs, whatever, it's not brilliant for them. So start to do different things with them. Mental stimulation is great. Hide and seek games, getting them to sniff and find something, taking a toy that you then hide, they have to go and find. So they can do low impact movement, but they're still getting mental stimulation, and it's not just mindlessly throwing a ball. Now, see lots of dog owners, they're walking the dog, they're on the phone, they're not actually paying much attention to the dog. Can relate this back to the food equals love. Actually, if you're out on the walk, or the clients are out on the walk with the dog and they're playing with them and giving them things to do and exercises, that's going to bond that dog far more to the owner than just food, and it's going to be better for the owner's mental welfare as well as the dog's mental welfare. So I really try and encourage this. Unpredictable, uneven surfaces, they will cope with it. You see the dog on the right, he's struggling through, but next day he's going to be pretty sore. So you just have to be aware of what impact that's going to have on them. Get them to and from their walks. You'll see them. They'll pause, they'll shuffle before jumping in and out of the car, because they're anticipating the pain that's going to be involved in jumping up and down. So they may sit in the car. Sometimes they have the, oh, my dog won't get out of the car. It's because it's really painful for him to jump out of the car. So there's loads of non-slip ramps available. So teaching the dog to go up and down the ramp is really useful. I've got a couple of clients that I've been speaking to with their older dog, and they've actually started training the younger dog to use the ramp now when they're not painful before they have to use it. So that's actually quite a nice thing to do. Keeping them warm. So as you know yourself, if you do have any aches or pains yourself, the colder you are, the more it aches. So keeping them nice and warm definitely can have a significant effect on some dogs with arthritic pain. And actually, one of the questions in the load score scheme is your dog worse when it's cold? It does, there is individual variation, but generally, the colder it is, the more effect it has. So coats, these are, it's called an equifleece. So if you can see, the fleecy jacket goes all the way down over the joints. So rather than just covering their back, it covers the legs as well. So those are a really nice jacket to use. Make sure they're not left out cold at the end of the walk. So really dry them off, keep them warm. As a dog bag, you put the dog in the whole bag, and including their feet, just make sure they're really warm and dry, hair dryers, whatever. Try not to get them owners to hose them off at the end of the walk. That's going to be pretty miserable for these arthritic dogs. So dry them off, get them clean, brush out the mud afterwards. So we're nearly at the end of the presentation. Just a little mention about cutting-edge therapies, because you may hear about these things in conferences or in journals and things like that. Stem cell therapy. I've done this in a few dogs. The idea is you harvest stem cells from the adipose tissue. And the system I use, we send them off to a lab, they get filtered, checked for bacteria, and then grown on to get a good healthy population of stem cells, and then I inject them back into the arthritic joint. And I've done this on a few dogs, and certainly we do see a big benefit in the first couple of weeks. Obviously, we try these things with the worst dogs first. So with my really bad couple of elbow joints, I did first, brilliant for the first 4 months. did start to become lame again after that period of time. But what I did notice is there's still improved mobility in the joints. So we did have to top back up with non-steroidals, but they had still had better mobility in the joints than prior to treatment. So it's an interesting thing to watch. Watch the emergence of these, but I think for some dogs it can really help. I've also done it in younger dogs, particularly with elbow disease. So they've got an MCP or something like that. Doing some stem cell therapy seems to slow the progression of the arthritis. Costs a bit of money, but some owners are going to be well up for that. And PRP, platelet-rich plasma, again, there is some work out there that it does give some benefit. The stem cell therapy that I have used comes in PRP. You can do it as a separate kit. You can get in-house kits. You can send it away. You can have a centrifuge system. There's different pros and cons to the different systems. But again, sometimes this is something that you will see in the veterinary press or maybe come across at congresses. And again, I have seen some benefit. I'd still go weight management, NSAIDs, exercise management before any of this stuff. But it's useful to know what is out there. So, thank you very much for listening to me go on about arthritis. I'm really passionate about this subject. I hope I've given you some enthusiasm for how you can really help old arthritic pets. I know a lot of the talk has been about dogs. Hopefully, I've brought some aspects of cat management into it as well. And I think it is definitely an area that a team-based approach is going to give the best benefit and the best improvement in quality of life for our older pets. And I think I personally feel we owe it to our older animals to give them the best retirement that we possibly can. If there's any questions, then I'm happy to receive them. If not, I will hand back over to Uma. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Lizzie for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.